Okay, so continuing on this theme of the acquiring skill and looking at the ground, the gardening that needs to be done, the work that needs to be done, the next reading I'll do from the Digha Nikaya. Second discourse of the Digha Nikaya, Samanyapala Sutta, the fruits of the homeless life. So, considering the various fruits, benefits that arise from the training and practice, and also just well, what are the things that need to be trained in, and how are they? What is their result? This Dhamma is heard by a householder, a householder's son, and one reborn in some family or other. Having heard this Dhamma, he gains faith in the Tathagata. Having gained this faith, he reflects. The household life is close and dusty. The homeless life is free as air. It is not easy living the household life to live the fully perfected holy life, purified and polished like a conch shell. Suppose I were to shave off my hair and beard, don yellow robes, and go forth from the household life into homelessness. And after some time, he abandons his property, small or great, leaves his circle of relatives, small or great, shaves off his hair and beard, dons yellow robes, and goes forth into the homeless life. And having gone forth, he dwells restrained by the restraint of the rules, persisting in right behavior, seeing danger in the slightest faults, observing the commitments he has taken on regarding body, deed, and word, devoted to the skilled and purified life, perfected in morality, with the sense doors guarded, skilled in mindful awareness and content. And how, sire, is a monk perfected in morality, abandoning the taking of life? He dwells refraining from taking life, without stick or sword, scrupulous, compassionate, trembling for the welfare of all living beings. Thus he is accomplished in morality. Abandoning the taking of what is not given, abandoning an unchastity, and so on through the, there's three sections in morality. It's quite long and extensive, actually, especially on the conduct of a samana, and because it goes into both the kind of moral issues as well as the aspects of right livelihood and proper proper conduct for bhikkhus. It's like the whereas some ascetics and Brahmins remain addicted to such games and idle pursuits as 8 or 10 row chess in the air, hopscotch, spillikins, dicing, hitting sticks, hand pictures, ball games, blowing through toy pipes, playing with toy plows, turning somersaults, playing with toy windmills, measures, carriages, and bows, guessing letters, guessing thoughts, mimicking deformities, the ascetic Gotama refrains from such idle pursuits. It goes through all the aspects of morality and appropriate conduct for a samana, which I won't go through. And then, sire, that monk who has perfected morality sees no danger from any side owing to his being restrained by morality, just as a duly anointed Kshatriya king, the warrior noble, having conquered his enemies by that very fact, sees no danger from any side. So the monk, on account of his morality, sees no danger anywhere. He experiences in himself the blameless bliss that comes from maintaining this Aryan morality. In this way, sire, he is perfected in morality. And how, sire, is he a guardian of the sense doors? Here a monk, on seeing a visible object with the eye, does not grasp at its major signs or secondary characteristics, because greed and sorrow, evil, unskilled states, would overwhelm him if he dwelt, leaving this eye faculty unguarded. So he practices guarding it. He protects the eye faculty, develops restraint of the eye faculty. On hearing a sound with the ear, on smelling an odor with the nose, on tasting a flavor with the tongue, on feeling an object with the body, on thinking a thought with the mind, he does not grasp at its major signs or secondary characteristics. He develops the restraint of the mind faculty. He experiences within himself the blameless bliss that comes from maintaining this Aryan guarding of the faculties. In this way, sire, a monk is a guardian of the sense doors. And how, sire, is a monk accomplished in mindfulness and clear awareness? Here a monk acts with clear awareness in going forth and back, in looking ahead or behind him, in bending and stretching, in wearing his outer and inner robe and carrying his bowl, in eating, drinking, chewing and swallowing, in evacuating and urinating, in walking, standing, sitting, lying down, in waking, in speaking, and in keeping silent. He acts with clear awareness. In this way, a monk is accomplished in mindfulness and clear awareness. And how is a monk contented? Here a monk is satisfied with a robe to protect his body, with alms to satisfy his stomach, and having accepted sufficient, he goes on his way. Just as a bird with wings flies hither and thither, burdened by nothing but its wings, so he is satisfied. In this way, sire, a monk is contented. Then he, equipped with this Aryan morality, with this Aryan restraint of the senses, with this Aryan contentment, finds a solitary lodging at the root of a forest tree, in a mountain cave or gorge, a charnel ground, a jungle thicket, or in the open air on a heap of straw. Then, having eaten after his return from the alms round, he sits down cross-legged, holding his body erect, and concentrates on keeping mindfulness established before him. Abandoning worldly desires, he dwells with a mind freed from worldly desires, and his mind purified of them. Abandoning ill will and hatred, and by compassionate love for the welfare of all living beings, his mind is purified of ill will and hatred. Abandoning sloth and torpor, perceiving light, mindful and clearly aware, his mind is purified of sloth and torpor. Abandoning worry and flurry, and with an inwardly calmed mind, his mind is purified of worry and flurry. Abandoning doubt, he dwells with doubt left behind, without uncertainty as to what things are wholesome, his mind is purified of doubt. Just as a man who had taken a loan to develop his business, and whose business had prospered, might pay off his old debts, and with what was left over could support a wife, might think, before this I developed my business by borrowing, but now it has prospered, and he would rejoice and be glad about that. Just as a man who was ill, suffering, terribly sick, with no appetite and weak in body, might after a time recover and regain his appetite and bodily strength, and he might think, before this I was ill, and he would rejoice and be glad about that. Just as a man might be bound in prison, and after a time he might be freed from his bonds without any loss, with no deduction from his possessions, he might think, before this I was in prison, and he would rejoice and be glad about that. Just as a man might be a slave, not his own master, dependent on another, unable to go where he liked, and after some time he might be freed from slavery, able to go where he liked, and might think, before this I was a slave, and he would rejoice and be glad about that. Just as a man laden with goods and wealth might go on a long journey through the desert, where food was scarce and danger abounded, and after a time he would get through the desert and arrive safe and sound at the edge of a village, might think, before this I was in danger, now I am safe at the edge of a village. And he would rejoice and be glad about that. As long, sire, as a monk does not perceive the disappearance of the five hindrances in himself, he feels as if in debt, in sickness, in bonds, in slavery, on a desert journey. But when he perceives the disappearance of the five hindrances in himself, it is as if he were freed from debt, from sickness, from bonds, from slavery, from the perils of the desert. And when he knows that these five hindrances have left him, gladness arises in him. From gladness comes delight. And from the delight in his body is tranquilized. With a tranquil body he feels joy, and with joy his mind is concentrated. Being thus detached from sense desires, detached from unwholesome states, he enters and remains in the first jhana, which is with thinking and pondering, born of detachment, filled with delight and joy. And with this delight and joy born of detachment, he so suffuses, drenches, fills and irradiates his body that there is no spot in his entire body that is untouched by this delight and joy born of detachment. Just as a skilled bathman or his assistant, kneading the soap powder which he has sprinkled with water, forms from it in a metal dish a soft lump, so that the ball of soap powder becomes one oleaginous mass bound with oil so that nothing escapes. So this monk suffuses, drenches, fills, and irradiates his body so that no spot remains untouched. This, sire, is a fruit of the homeless life, visible here and now, that is more excellent and perfect than the former ones. Again, a monk with the subsiding of thinking and pondering, by gaining inner tranquility and oneness of mind, enters and remains in the second jhana, which is without thinking and pondering, born of concentration, filled with delight and joy. And with this delight and joy born of concentration, he so suffuses his body that no spot remains untouched. Just as a lake fed by a spring with no inflow from east, west, north, or south, where the rain god sends moderate showers from time to time, the water welling up from below, mingling with cool water, would suffuse, fill, and irradiate that cool water, so that no part of the pool was untouched by it. So with this delight and joy born of concentration, he so suffuses his body that no spot remains untouched. This, sire, is a fruit more excellent and perfect than the former ones. Again, a monk with the fading away of delight remains imperturbable, mindful, and clearly aware, and experiences in himself that joy of which the noble ones say, "Happy is he who dwells with equanimity and mindfulness." And he enters and remains in the third jhana. And with this joy devoid of delight, he so suffuses his body that no spot remains untouched. Just as if in a pond of blue, red, or white lotuses, in which the flowers, born in the water, grown in the water, not growing out of the water, are fed from the water's depths, those blue, red, or white lotuses would be suffused with the cool water. So with this joy devoid of delight, the monk so suffuses his body that no spot remains untouched. This is the fruit of the homeless life, more excellent and perfect than the former ones. Again, a monk, having given up pleasure and pain, and with the disappearance of former gladness and sadness, enters and remains in the fourth jhana, which is beyond pleasure and pain, and purified by equanimity and mindfulness. And he sits, suffusing his body with that mental purity and clarification, so that no part of his body is untouched by it. Just as if a man were to sit wrapped from head to foot in a white garment, so that no part of him was untouched by that garment, so his body is suffused. This is the fruit of the homeless life, more excellent and perfect than the former ones. And so with mind concentrated, purified, and cleansed, unblemished, free from impurities, malleable, workable, established, and having gained imperturbability, he directs and inclines his mind towards knowing and seeing. And he knows, this my body is material, made up from the four great elements, born of mother and father, fed on rice and gruel, impermanent, liable to be injured and abraded, broken and destroyed. And this is my consciousness, which is bound to it and dependent on it. It is just as if there were a gem, a barrel, pure, excellent, well cut into eight facets, clear, bright, unflawed, perfect in every respect, strung on a blue, yellow, red, white, or orange cord. A man with good eyesight, taking it in his hand and inspecting it, would describe it as such. In the same way, sire, a monk with mind concentrated, purified, and cleansed, directs his mind towards knowing and seeing, and he knows, this my body is material made up of the four great elements, and this is my consciousness, which is bound to it and dependent on it. This is the fruit of the homeless life, more excellent and perfect than the former ones. And then it, the sutta continues with descriptions of the attainment of psychic powers and the knowledges, the limit of the liberation from the taints. So that there's the whole range of those fruits and things that need to be cultivated, and something that always struck me in that discourse is the the happiness that arises from on the different levels of from morality, sense restraint, contentment. All of those things are the cause of different forms of happiness and well-being, and those are all things to be cultivated and recognized, and that is a tangible benefit. And then also the part of the reading was the dealing with the five hindrances, and particularly as in meditation, these are important aspects to be continually referring to and working with, putting effort into to bring them into abeyance, or to understand how they arise and how they can be brought to cessation. And this next reading is another set of similes with the hindrances. And this is Sanyutta 46, Sutta number 55. Atsavati. Then the Brahman, Sangarava, approached the Blessed One and exchanged greetings with him. When they had concluded their greetings and cordial talk, he sat down to one side and said to the Blessed One, Master Gotama, what is the cause and reason why sometimes even those hymns that have been recited over a long period do not recur to the mind, let alone those that have not been recited? What is the cause and reason why sometimes those hymns that have not been recited over a long period recur to the mind, let alone those that have been recited? Brahman, when one dwells with a mind obsessed with sensual lust, overwhelmed by sensual lust, and one does not understand as it really is the escape from arisen sensual lust, on that occasion one neither knows nor sees as it really is one's own good, or the good of others, or the good of both. Then even those hymns that have been recited over a long period do not recur to the mind, let alone those that have not been recited. Suppose, Brahman, there is a bowl of water mixed with lac, turmeric, blue dye, or crimson dye. If a man with good sight were to examine his own facial reflection in it, he would neither know nor see it as it really is. So too, Brahman, when one dwells with a mind obsessed by sensual lust, on that occasion, even those hymns that have been recited over a long period do not recur to the mind, let alone those that have not been recited. Again, Brahman, when one dwells with a mind obsessed by ill will, overwhelmed by ill will, and one does not understand as it really is the escape from arisen ill will, on that occasion, one neither knows nor sees as it really is one's own good, or the good of others, or the good of both. Then even those hymns that have been recited over a long period do not recur to the mind, let alone those that have not been recited. Suppose, Brahman, there is a bowl of water being heated over a fire, bubbling and boiling. If a man with good sight were to examine his own facial reflection in it, he would neither know nor see it as it really is. So too, Brahman, when one dwells with a mind obsessed by ill will, on that occasion, even those hymns that have been recited over a long period do not recur to the mind, let alone those that have not been recited. Again, Brahman, when one dwells with a mind obsessed by sloth and torpor, overwhelmed by sloth and torpor, and one does not understand it, stand as it really is, the escape from arisen sloth and torpor, on that occasion, one neither knows nor sees as it really is one's own good or the good of others or the good of both. Then even those hymns that have been recited over a long period do not recur to the mind, let alone those that have not been recited. Suppose, Brahman, there is a bowl of water covered over with water plants and algae. If a man with good sight were to examine his own facial reflection in it, he would neither know nor see it as it really is. So too, Brahman, when one dwells with a mind obsessed by sloth and torpor, on that occasion, even those hymns that have been recited over a long period do not recur to the mind, let alone those that have not been recited. Again, Brahman, when one dwells with a mind obsessed by restlessness and remorse, overwhelmed by restlessness and remorse, and one does not understand as it really is the escape from arisen or restlessness and remorse, on that occasion one neither knows nor sees as it really is one's own good or the good of others or the good of both, then even those hymns that have been recited over a long period do not recur to the mind, let alone those that have not been recited. Suppose, Brahman, there is a bowl of water, stirred by the wind, rippling, swirling, churned into wavelets. If a man with good sight were to examine his own facial reflection in it, he would neither know nor see it as it really is. So too, Brahman, when one dwells with a mind obsessed by restlessness and remorse, on that occasion, even those hymns that have been recited over a long period do not recur to the mind, let alone those that have not been recited. Again, Brahman, when one dwells with a mind obsessed by doubt, overwhelmed by doubt, and one does not understand as it really is the escape from arisen doubt, on that occasion, one neither knows nor sees as it really is one's own good or the good of others or the good of both, then even those hymns that have been recited over a long period do not recur to the mind, let alone those that have not been recited. Suppose, Brahman, there is a bowl of water that is turbid, unsettled, muddy, placed in the dark. If a man with good sight were to examine his own facial reflection in it, he would neither know nor see it as it really is. So too, Brahman, when one dwells with a mind obsessed by doubt, on that occasion, even those hymns that have been recited over a long period do not recur to the mind, let alone those that have not been recited. This, Brahman, is the cause and reason why even those hymns that have been recited over a long period do not recur to the mind, let alone those that have not been recited. And of course, the sutta goes on to this opposite in that day. Pardon? Hymns. Oh, well, that was what the Vedic hymns were. That was the duty of the Brahmins would be the reciting of these ancient hymns, and that was both in terms of ritual ceremony that they would be performing in, that would cover all sorts of occasions, as well as their own personal practice. The next sutta is another one around the five hindrances, another image again. This is Sanyutta 46, sutta number 33. Bhikkhus, there are these five corruptions of gold, corrupted by which gold is neither malleable, nor wieldy, nor radiant, but brittle, and not properly fit for work. What 5? Iron is a corruption of gold, corrupted by which gold is neither malleable, nor wieldy, nor radiant, but brittle, and not properly fit for work. Copper is a corruption of gold, tin is a corruption of gold, lead is a corruption of gold, silver is a corruption of gold. These are the 5 corruptions of gold, corrupted by which gold is neither malleable, nor wieldy, nor radiant, but brittle, and not properly fit for work. So too, bhikkhus, there are these 5 corruptions of the mind, corrupted by which the mind is neither malleable, nor wieldy, nor radiant, but brittle, and not rightly concentrated for the destruction of the taints. What 5? Sensual desire is a corruption of the mind, corrupted by which the mind is neither malleable, nor wieldy, nor radiant, but brittle, and not rightly concentrated for the destruction of the taints. Ill will is a corruption of the mind, sloth and torpor are a corruption of the mind. Restlessness and remorse are a corruption of the mind. Doubt is a corruption of the mind. These are the 5 corruptions of the mind, corrupted by which the mind is neither malleable, nor wieldy, nor radiant, but brittle, and not rightly concentrated for the destruction of the taints. So this next sutta is the from Majjhima. Majjhima 7, it's the Vatupama Sutta, the simile of the cloth. And sort of continuing on this theme of in cultivation and working with different things, extending the skill in working with the mind to include sort of more, a bit more detail. There'll be called imperfections of the mind, imperfections that defile the mind will be talked about, and those the word from Pali is the upikilesa, and that word upikilesa is a word that is sometimes used with sort of stains of meditative attainment, sometimes with kind of the stains of insight. And sometimes as in this discourse, it's a bit more general, referring to varieties of defilements arising in the mind, sort of the more sort of smaller branches and twigs of greed, hatred, and delusion. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savati in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's Park. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus." "Venerable Sir," they replied, "the Blessed One said this, 'Bhikkhus, suppose a cloth were defiled and stained, and a dyer dipped it in some dye or other, whether blue or yellow or red or pink. It would look poorly dyed, and impure in color. Why is that? Because of the impurity of the cloth. So too, when the mind is defiled, an unhappy destination may be expected. Because suppose a cloth were pure and bright, and a dyer dipped it in some dye or other, whether blue or yellow or red or pink, it would look well dyed and pure in color. Why is that? Because of the purity of the cloth. So too, when the mind is undefiled, a happy destination may be expected. What, bhikkhus, are the imperfections that defile the mind? Covetousness and unrighteous greed is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Ill will is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Anger is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Revenge is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Contempt is an imperfection that defiles the mind. A domineering attitude is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Envy is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Avarice is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Deceit is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Fraud is an imperfection that defiles the mind. obstinacy is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Presumption is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Conceit is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Arrogance is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Vanity is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Negligence is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Knowing that covetousness and unrighteous greed is an imperfection that defiles the mind, a bhikkhu abandons it. Knowing that ill will, anger, revenge, contempt, a domineering attitude, envy, avarice, deceit, fraud, obstinacy, presumption, conceit, arrogance, vanity, negligence, knowing that negligence is an imperfection that defiles the mind, a bhikkhu abandons it. When a bhikkhu has known that covetousness and unrighteous greed is an imperfection that defiles the mind and has abandoned it, when a bhikkhu has known that ill will and so on through to negligence is an imperfection that defiles the mind and has abandoned it, he acquires perfect confidence in the Buddha thus. The Blessed One is accomplished, fully enlightened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, sublime, knower of worlds, incomparable leader of persons to be tamed, teacher of gods and humans, enlightened, blessed. He acquires perfect confidence in the Dhamma thus. The Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One, visible here and now, immediately effective, inviting inspection, onward leading, to be experienced by the wise for themselves. He acquires perfect confidence in the Sangha thus. The Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples is practicing the good way, practicing the straight way, practicing the true way, practicing the proper way, that is, the four pairs of persons, the eight types of individuals. This Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples is worthy of gifts, worthy of hospitality, worthy of offerings, worthy of reverential salutation, the unsurpassed field of merit for the world. When he has given up, expelled, released, abandoned, and relinquished the imperfections of the mind in part, he considers thus, I am possessed of perfect confidence in the Buddha, and he gains inspiration in the meaning, gains inspiration in the Dhamma, gains gladness connected with the Dhamma. When he is glad, rapture is born in him. In one who is rapturous, the body becomes tranquil. One whose body is tranquil feels pleasure. In one who feels pleasure, the mind becomes concentrated. He considers thus, I am possessed of perfect confidence in the Dhamma. And he gains inspiration in the meaning, gains inspiration in the Dhamma, gains gladness connected with the Dhamma. When he is glad, and so on, through that, the mind becomes concentrated. He considers thus, I am possessed of perfect confidence in the Sangha, and he gains inspiration in the meaning, gains inspiration in the Dhamma, gains gladness connected with the Dhamma. When he is glad, the mind becomes concentrated. He considers thus, the imperfections of the mind have in part been given up, expelled, released, abandoned, and relinquished by me. And he gains inspiration in the meaning, gains inspiration in the Dhamma, gains gladness connected with the Dhamma. When he is glad, rapture is born in him. In one who is rapturous, the body becomes tranquil. One whose body is tranquil feels pleasure. In one who feels pleasure, the mind becomes concentrated. Because if a bhikkhu of such virtue, such a state of concentration, and such wisdom eats alms food consisting of choice hill rice along with various sauces and curries, even that will be no obstacle for him. Just as a cloth that is defiled and stained becomes pure and bright with the help of clear water, or just as gold becomes pure and bright with the help of a furnace, so too, if a bhikkhu of such virtue eats alms food, choice alms food like that, that will be no obstacle for him. He abides pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness. Likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth. So above, below, around, and everywhere. And to all as to himself. He abides, pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving-kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. He abides, pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with compassion, with a mind imbued with appreciative joy, with a mind imbued with equanimity, likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth. So above, below, around, and everywhere, and to all as to himself, he abides pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with equanimity, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. He understands thus, there is this, there is the inferior, there is the superior, and beyond there is an escape from this whole field of perception. So that knowing that, this saying that I'm seeing the different grades of what is possible, there's there is the escape from the whole field of perception is referring to Nibbana. When he knows and sees thus, his mind is liberated from the taint of sensual desire, from the taint of being, and from the taint of ignorance. When it is liberated, there comes the knowledge. It is liberated. He understands. Birth is destroyed. The holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming to any state of being. Bhikkhus, this bhikkhu is called one bathed with the inner bathing. And then the sutta goes on after that. That catches the interest of a Brahmin in the audience, who then asks him, well, does the Master Gotama go to the such and such a river to bathe? And you know, and the Buddha goes in, well, why? And explains him of the whole idea of creating both merit and purification from the Buddha's perspective, and then of course that Brahmin gains faith and becomes a asked for admission into the Sangha. Well, I think in that sense what happens is obviously one has a certain modicum of faith already to start putting the teachings into practice and to even try letting go of these various defilements. And then by letting go, then we say, wow, the Buddha was really right. Oh God, this feels good. So the confidence becomes very well established out of one's own experience. Okay, we'll leave it there for the day. Namayam Dhammakathāya Sātukāraṁ Pathāmāt